Welcome to Mill Liberty, the voice of liberty for a new generation.
All right, Joe Walsh,
Matt Kibbe,
John Stossel, welcome to Mill Liberty.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Hey, Caleb, I mean this. It's great to be with you. Thank you for the invite.
This week, we are going to be going over the myths and realities that surround monopolies. Teddy Roosevelt hated small government. The gateway into space will help alleviate a lot of this problem.
It was a fateful error we took 100 years ago with this kind of monopolization of banking and centralization of money and credit.
Automation, streamlined productivity, and cost effectiveness.
There's two big government parties, and one of them is red and one of them is blue.
We are creating a community of liberty lovers. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. And we are back for yet another edition of the Mill Liberty Podcast. I, of course, am your host, Caleb Franz. This is the voice of liberty for a new generation. I am thrilled to have you be a part of this program this week. I'm thrilled to have you listen in and contribute to the growing community of liberty lovers that we are trying to build here as part of this podcast, as part of this network, as part of this organization. There are so many things, so many different facets that we're trying to accomplish, and you are helping us do just that. So real quick, first, as we get started here, as I like to try to say at the beginning and the end of every episode, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast so that way, one, you'll never miss an episode or an update. And then two, if you really love what we're doing here on the program, please be sure to go out and check us out on Patreon, because if you really want to support us, you can support us as little as $5 a month. That will help us grow as a podcast and as a network and as an organization. So if you really love what we're doing here, please consider going and supporting us there on Patreon. Now, let's get into this week's episode. I gotta tell you, this past week has been a complete whirlwind for me. I've been traveling almost nonstop, quite frankly, since we've last chatted here on the program, and I got a little bit close of getting a little worried about not being able to provide an episode this week, but nevertheless, we have one here today, and today we are going to be continuing our Horrors of Collectivism series, as we are doing throughout the entirety of the month of October. It's getting closer and closer to Halloween. Halloween is my favorite holiday, or at least one of my top two or three holidays that I love to celebrate and partake in, and it's one that is also sort of set in the month that is historically known for its connections to the atrocities of communism and socialism, the Red October of the Red Revolution and the October Revolution from Lenin, as well as when Mao rose to power and instituted a communist government in the late 40s. And then there is the instances of course, because this is, of course, a collectivism series, this sort of encompasses all of the isms that you could possibly think of that are deadly in nature. And as you recall, over the past few weeks, first we had Larry Reed on to go over some of the lesser known despots and tyrants throughout history that carried out their horrible atrocities in the name of collectivism, in the name of communism or socialism or something of the like. And then we had Daniel DiMartino, and he came on to discuss the situation that's unfolding, continuing to unfold to this day here in Venezuela. And he's been doing a lot of great stuff. He's been traveling almost as much as I have, basically telling his story, getting his word out there about the dangers of socialism and his and the strength that comes with freedom and liberty. And then last week, of course, we had Lily Tang Williams. Now, Lily was a great guest of mine. She was a really kind person that I really had a pleasure of speaking with. And she, of course, grew up in communist China. And there was a lot of perspective, I think, that she had to offer. And I highly encourage you to go back and listen to all of those episodes. They are all really important. But this week we are going to hit a little bit closer to home. This week I have brought on Michael Frick. Now, Michael is someone who we've had here on the program before. Back in, I want to say, mid-May, it was right before I went to go speak at the Libertarian Party of Ohio, their state convention that they have, that they had in Toledo this past year. I went to go speak there and gave, I think, a rather engaging, interactive presentation. And Michael was sort of my point man for that. And he is a very intelligent man, and he has a lot of historical knowledge, specifically about the region of Ohio. And his point that he wants to bring up in connection to this week's episode for the Horrors of Collectivism series is about the deep state and how the deep state has a lot of deep-seated roots in Ohio. If you don't know, I'm from Ohio, obviously, as is he, which is obviously why I sort of went over and spoke to the LP here in Ohio. But also, he's from the Akron, Cleveland area. So there's a lot of connections that he sort of lays out in presentation for this week's episode about the connections there that the deep state has to Ohio. Really fascinating stories. And I think it's really important to understand that the deep state is not like when it's easy to get caught up in whenever people hear somebody talk about the deep state, it's usually like images of these like dark hooded figures just standing around ominously, like pulling the figure or pulling or pressing buttons and pulling levers, I should say, and being the puppet masters behind the curtain for the presidents and Congress and all of these different things. That's not necessarily what we're talking about. However, the reality of it is perhaps just as frightening, because the deep state comes from people who some have very well-meaning intentions, others do not. But it comes from the fact that much like communism and much like socialism, and I touch on this much later in the episode in the interview, much like all these other deadly isms, the state of bureaucracy and the forever government that is just constantly there, people who are constantly embedded in the state regardless of administrations, regardless of who's in power, what party controls the chambers of Congress, what leader controls the White House, what president controls the White House and the executive branch. These people are constantly there, and they're constantly driving the warfare state forward. They're constantly driving inflation and the Fed and doing all these things behind the scenes where they don't have any checks to their power. Not really. There's, you know, maybe literally or maybe, you know, on the books there might be some so-called checks in their power, but it doesn't really work. They never really go away. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the deep state, is usually this deep-seated bureaucracy that just grows into this ugly, vicious monster that never goes away, becomes unchecked, and its power becomes way too great to solve in just one sitting administration. That's why even if we get, say, a libertarian president one day in our lifetime, even in that instance, it's not going to be just a one presidency solution. This is a very deep-seated cultural fix that has to happen, because it's been going back for 100 years and more. It's not going to be easy to try to fix, but it's something that is still nevertheless important to understand and to discuss, so that way we can find solutions moving forward. So with that being said, I think Mike has a very interesting and a very compelling case to be made about the history of the deep state in Ohio and in the Cleveland area in particular. So I'm going to sit back and let the interview roll. So please enjoy my interview with Michael Frick on the origins of the deep state in Ohio. Okay, Mike, welcome back to the program. I am thrilled to have you on. Again, welcome back.
Thanks, Caleb. So we're going to talk about the Cleveland Mousetrap and the start of the deep state.
I'm very excited about that. This is going to be part of our Horrors of Collectivism series, and it's very different from some of the other interviews that we've had of this series for this year, because some of the other ones have been from people who've experienced collectivism, whether it be communism under China and Mao, or socialism under Venezuela with Maduro, and things like that. But this hits a little bit closer to home. So let's start out with just first of all, what is the general idea of what you're trying to convey, and we'll sort of go from there.
So my contention is that the deep state has very long roots, and I can trace them back to their start 100 years ago here in Cleveland.
So whenever, obviously, whenever people talk about the deep state, there's a couple different ideas that that come to mind. One is sort of this real deep embedded bureaucracy that is just constantly there, never leaving. And I think it's a little bit closer to an accurate portrayal of that. Sometimes people get a bit of a cartoonish vibe of what that is. It's a sinister tentacled organization or something like that. How would you describe that?
So the deep state for me is when there is no accountability in government. You know, you have a compartmentalized bureaucracy. The government doesn't even know what the government is doing.
Yeah.
And they justify it as saying that they're the only ones who can, you know, protect the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that they don't have to answer to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
They're not elected, and their mandate is permanent and not limited by any counteracting.
Any elections or, yeah, anything like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go ahead and get into the history here then. This starts back in 1917, correct?
correct. That's when Jim Cunant came to Willoughby, Ohio, and built the first factory of weapons of mass destruction in the United States.
And what were those weapons again?
He was building a Lewisite factory, which was, at the time, they thought it was the great American gas that would win World War One.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, back in World War One, there that was sort of the pinnacle of horrible weaponry. And today, we think of a weapon of mass destruction, we think of like a nuclear bomb or something like that. But back then, in some regards, it was even more horrific to use those sorts of devices just because of how long and excruciating the pain would be for people who would come in contact with it.
Well, we're going to draw that line right to nuclear weapons because Jim Cunant, after World War One, went on to become the president of Harvard, and during World War II, he was the architect of the Manhattan Project. He's the one who hired Oppenheimer. But in World War One, his secret laboratory was here in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's start out and sort of give us a basically what the story is about Cleveland and how it all sort of came to fruition up to today.
Okay. So in 1915, the Germans used chlorine gas at Ypres, and within 2 years, they were using mustard gas. America, remember, was late to the war, and in 1917, as the war approached, they didn't have any kind of offensive or defensive chemical weapon knowledge. So they hired they brought in the U.S. Bureau of Mines, which had experience with deadly gases, and eventually the effort sprawled to contain about 10% of all the chemists in the United States. The first site was at Spring Hill, where they did the research. And they had a testing grounds, which was basically two trenches, which were concentric circles. And they would, set off a charge of chlorine or mustard gas and see if it would travel from one trench to another. And they would put, dogs or goats and put them inside the second trench. The problem was that the site was in the middle of a city. So the trolley would come by and the wind would take it onto the neighbor's property. A couple of pets were killed. And they really knew that they had to move it out of Spring Valley, Washington, D.C. So the search was on for a new agent. Mustard gas was actually more of a defensive weapon. It's an aerial denial weapon because it lingers after it's used. It can pool on top of puddles of water and affect any troops that are advancing into the area. So the the chemical warfare agency went through a number of research efforts, and what they came across was a 15-year-old dissertation from Julius Newland. He's a famous chemist in his own right. He discovered the polymerization of acetylene to divinyl acetylene, which is synthetic rubber neoprene. But his dissertation was everything he had reacted acetylene with, and one of the things he had reacted it with was trichlorarsine. And the reaction had nearly killed him. He was in the hospital for several weeks. And actually, his advisor brought this reaction to the war effort. And one of the people who worked on it was Winfred Lewis. He was the director of the Chemical Warfare Service at Catholic University. And after several explosions and setbacks, he was able to isolate a oily liquid which had an amber color and the odor of geranium blossoms. And this compound became known as Lewisite. And it was very toxic. A single drop on the back of the hand could prove fatal within a couple hours. So in September 1917, Jim Conant, he was a Harvard chemist at the time. He became head of the organic research unit and perfected the manufacturing process. So in July of 1918, he moved to Willoughby, Ohio, and purchased an 11-acre site, which soon became a military base cordoned off with barbed wire. There weren't barracks or electricity or plumbing when he moved in, so all of this had to be built. And eventually, there were 22 officers and over 500 enlisted men. Some of the things he did was there was no address for the plant. He had a Cleveland post office box, which was locked drawer 426. It was used at the mailing address. The security at the plant was so tight that the soldiers dubbed it the mouse trap, as in whatever goes in never comes out. They told the locals that they were working on a new type of rubber, which was the explanation for the smells that were coming from the plant. But within a few months, they had reached full production, which was 10 tons a day. The chemical was never used in war because the German armistice came very quickly, and in November of 1918, the war was over, and the chemical had never been used. However, they had and the accounts differ on this, but the Cleveland Plain Dealer at the time reported that there was 300 tons of lewisite produced in Willoughby. What they did was they loaded it onto a train. They took all other train traffic off of the rail line and slowly took it all to Baltimore. The only person on the train who was not military was the conductor, and they loaded it into barges and took it 50 miles offshore and dumped it into the ocean.
That seems very safe.
The site was sold in 1919 to Ohio Rubber. It was Ohio Rubber until 1980. Ohio Rubber was actually their own type of polluter. A friend of mine grew up in the area and talked about, you know, having black snow from all the particulate that the Ohio Rubber Company put into the air. What's really interesting, though, is in 1957, 35 laboratory bottles were discovered in the ground containing the lewisite. And if you think about it, 100 years ago, they didn't really have chemical weapons or hazardous materials disposal. So what they did was, there was really two techniques. The first one I talked about was just dumping it into a body of water. The other one was to burn and bury it. And I'm sure they used both of them there. In 1980, it became demilled to iron and metal, which it still is. 1997, the chemical weapons were banned. And the Army Corps of Engineers has been studying the site since 2002. But the connection to the deep state is, Jim Kinant, after World War I, went back and became the president of Harvard. But during World War II, he was the architect of the Manhattan Plan. He was the one who, you know, was the intermediary between, you know, the scientists, Oppenheimer, and President Roosevelt. And some of the lessons that he learned at his first secret base in Willoughby was compartmentalization. So not everyone knew what was going on. Actually, they limited the number to as minimal as possible of what was going on. Los Alamos didn't have an address. They had a P.O. box in El Paso. But the deep state's roots come from, you know, one of the things we talk about is how prohibition never works. But when you're talking about chemical or nuclear or biological weapons, prohibition has to work. The agreements that they made after World War II with the other governments in the world to try and stop the proliferation is really the beginning of what we think of as world government. The compromises that they made with, you know, our sovereignty to have a world government is really the justification that was used to create this massive bureaucracy without accountability, because the ultimate goal was that these weapons could not become widely available. So, anyhow, that's my contention that the deep state started here in Ohio.
So, what I find interesting here is that, you know, when a lot of people hear a term such as that, usually there are deep-seated conspiracy ideas that immediately start to come to mind, or at least some imagery of, you know, people who might not necessarily be as trustworthy as others. But what you're really explaining, and what is really important to understand, is that even though it might sound nefarious or scary, it's a very easy slope to find ourselves in. For government to just constantly embed themselves in multiple layers, so that way, even as presidents come and go, as, you know, congressmen and senators come and go, all these people who are elected, the idea of the state and the idea of the further expansion of the state is constantly there, because those layers, while, you know, obviously you have elected officials coming and going all the time, those layers persist and those layers remain.
Right. I think one other key component is just contempt for the citizenry as well. You know, when they chose the site in Willoughby, I mean, there were some physical advantages. It was, you know, sparsely populated, away from the coasts and away from the spies. But it was also right on the railroad tracks and next to the Chagrin River, which were necessary to, you know, dispose of barrels that were leaking. They would, I'm sure, toss them into the Chagrin River. But the contempt for the citizenry is evident by Jim Kanant, who was offered a chance to be in charge of Ohio Rubber at the end of the war, and he turned him down. And Ohio Rubber, you know, they increased the offer, and he turned him down again. And Ohio Rubber wanted an explanation, and he told them that, well, you know, I'm married to a woman who would never live here in Ohio, and if she would live in Ohio, I would never be married to her.
So, wow. Yeah.
This kind of, you know, elitism is key to the deep state.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have this kind of egotism that only you can save the country, then there's no need for, you know, these isolated portions of government that have no accountability or no counteracting force in government.
Right. And what this sort of also reminds me of is, much like the other isms that we've been discussing throughout the series, it's not necessarily that the people are, by default, the people who become involved and rise to the top in these scenarios by default are necessarily bad people whenever they start, but it inevitably attracts those who are power hungry, those who have this sort of ambition that's very unhealthy for anyone to be seeking, you know, this kind of power, just like in Venezuela, just like in China. This is a situation where, just like in those other ones, it's an inevitability to it that people such as that will constantly be attracted to positions of power that really should not be having power.
Well, I mean, I can think that at the time, you know, it was pretty heroic to counteract what the Germans had started. But I don't think there was any you know, looking forward into the future. In fact, they, you know, never cleaned up their mess. They just dumped it into the ocean. The site has never really been explored to see, is there arsenic in the ground? The parent site in Spring Hill, Washington is the only residential neighborhood in the U.S. that was a former chemical weapons testing ground. And they've had all kinds of problems with arsenic in the ground. They had to take up 3 feet of soil at the Australian embassy, which is located in that neighborhood. But here in Willoughby, it's just kind of been forgotten about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are starting to wind down here for the program. But Mike, I do want to go ahead and plug a few things in for you. So, first of all, you're still involved with the Libertarian Party here in Ohio, correct?
Yes, I'm on the executive committee as a at-large member.
And also, thank you for inviting me to your convention this past summer. We had a very good conversation in Toledo with a fairly receptive crowd to what I had to say. So I appreciate that first and foremost. Where can people find information about that, as well as where can people find information about the subject matter here on the program that we discussed today, and of course about yourself as well?
Sure. So the next convention will be in the summer of 2020. You can find more information on the Libertarian Party of Ohio. As for myself, I'm pretty easy to find. I'm in Portage County, Ohio. I'm the chair of the Akron section of the American Chemical Society, and I do public speaking pretty frequently. I'll be talking about the mousetrap and the connection to the Manhattan Project to the Akron Physics Club in November. the Cleveland section of the American Chemical Society has me as their speaker in January. Both of those talks are open to the public if you're in the area.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, Mike, I appreciate you you coming on to the program today. I appreciate you being a part of our Horrors of Collectivism series, because I think this is a little bit different than what some of the other ones may be, but I think it's also very interesting and very important to discuss about. So thank you again for coming on, and we'll have to have you on again soon.
Yep. Take care, Kel.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to do it for us for this week's edition of the Mill Liberty Podcast. I am so thrilled to have your support for this program. If you haven't done so already, like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast so that way you'll never miss an episode or an update. Be sure to check us out on Patreon if you might be interested in that. Also, be sure to follow me at Caleb Franz on Twitter. Be sure to follow the show at Mill Liberty on Twitter, and then follow the organization at Mill Liberty Org. We have a lot of really great stuff coming through the pipes right now. And then check us out on Facebook at the Mill Liberty Initiative. Of course, we're at millliberty.com. I'd like to thank Mike Frick for coming on to the podcast once again to discuss the Deep State for our Horrors of Collectivism series. Next week is going to be Halloween, so we're going to try to have a very special guest and very special episode for that edition of the program. Wrapping up our final Horrors of Collectivism series episode for this year. So, until next week, we'll see you.